Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem. Assalamu Aleichem. Namaste. Pak Sadnam Sat Sri Akal Tashi Dalek. Ho Lila Tanyan Wasiyake. Hello. May everything be well with you as it is with me. Check my recording levels here. And that looks okay, so we're good there. Welcome to this afternoon, this evening's live teaching in Neil Sabbatean Kabbalah. I'm Reb Yeshua ben Yaakov Leib. Welcome. Before we get started with today's teaching, I'm going to recite, as I do every day before the start of class, in honor of our ancestors who have walked this path before us, the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So please show reverence. Close your eyes as you listen, and remember someone to whom you were close who has passed away. In doing so, you'll honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your own consciousness. Yiskadal v'yishkadash me rabo, bomo di ve'ro kirase, ve'yamlik melkase, b'kayakon uvyo mekon, uvkaye dekol b'is Yisrael, ba'agalo uvizman koryev, ve'imru omein. Yehe shme rabo mavorak, le'olam ule ome omayo, yisbarak ve'yistabak ve'yisparar ve'yisromam ve'yisnase ve'yishadar ve'yishale ve'yishalal shmeidu kadsho beraku. Le'elo min kol berkaso v'sheroso, tush bekoso v'nekamoso, da'amiron be'olmo ve'imru omein. Yehe shlomo rabo min shamayo, ve'kayim aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael, ve'imru omein. Ose shalom bimromov, huyashe shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael, ve'imru omein. Thank you very much. As you know, if you've attended the last few classes, you know that right now we are in the middle of a brief survey of the early books of Kabbalah. And what I mean by that is the books upon which Kabbalah are based, the books which the books which Kabbalistic teachings and Kabbalistic teachers reference and quote and cite, and in which they have recorded the revelations that have been handed down to them by their teachers from time immemorial to the time in which they recorded them, because these teachings were handed down teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, in a tradition, in a succession called the tradition, Kabbalah, meaning receiving, and that's what is being passed on and received, are these teachings, from time immemorial. And then eventually they were written down, first in the form of notes by students, and then these notes would be compiled by the students after their teacher passed on and would be rewritten, compiled and edited and rewritten. And then these would be taught by that teacher to that teacher's students, and so on and so forth, down through the generations. This is very much a generational thing. And as you'll notice, when I start each class, and I mentioned to you today that before I start each class, I recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead, and I said that I do this out of respect for our ancestors. And this is a generational thing. Our ancestors, as I said, who have walked this path before us. You see, we are not the first generation to walk the path in search of God, in search of Torah. We are the 100th or 200th or 1,000th generation. We don't know how many generations have walked this path. Mankind has been walking this path ever since he was created by the Creator God. has been walking this path since before there were any religions, since before there was a religion called Christianity, a religion called Islam, a religion called even Judaism. Before there was any religion at all that was, that there is even a concept known as religion by man. Mankind has walked this path since the day he was created. Why? Because God has stamped his image upon the heart of each and every individual human being. When I say upon his heart, I don't mean the physical machine that pumps the blood through our veins. I'm referring now in a metaphorical way to the heart-mind, to the soul of each individual, the soul that was blown originally into the very first man slash woman created by God, named Adam slash Hava, Adam and Eve. When it says in Genesis 2:7 that God blew into his nostril the breath of life, a soul, and he became a living being, Kaya. And so at that point, man was differentiated from the animals. He obtained a divine soul, not an animal soul. All living beings, other than plants, have animal souls. This is called the nephesh. N as in neighbor, E, S as in Samuel, H, E, F as in fraternity. And every living being, including a human being that is not a plant, has an animal soul, a nephesh. But what distinguishes, and I'm not leaving out plants here, plants have plant souls, but I'm not going to get into that right here. But every living being on this planet that is an animal, including human beings, because we are animals, different animals for sure, special animals for sure, because we alone of all the animals were created in the image and likeness, the form and likeness of the Creator, of God. But we are differentiated because in addition to that nefesh, we have a ruach. A ruach. Ruach is Hebrew for spirit or breath or wind. As in, God's ruach blew or hovered over the deep in like the second verse, the first or second verse of the book of Genesis. As in Ruach HaKadesh. And of course, in that first example, that would be wind. God's wind. God's breath. God's spirit. It means all of those things. And as in Ruach HaKadesh, the Holy Spirit. Ruach meaning spirit. Kadesh meaning holy. That comes upon people in which when God, through his grace, decides to reveal something to that person. It is said that the Ruach HaKadesh came upon him or her and spoke to him or her and revealed a secret or many secrets to him or her. All right, so mankind has had the image of God stamped upon his soul. And that soul came down from heaven and occupied the physical body in which you and me and every other person living is bound to as long as we are alive in this plane of existence, in this world. And then when we die, the body returns to the dust from which it was made, and the soul goes upward, returns to God who made the soul. And this has been the way it is ever since the first man and woman, Adam, the Hava. And Evie 18, please do not private message me when I'm teaching. It's rude. So please do not do that. Do not interrupt me. If you have something to ask me, please wait until after the teaching's done. And I'll be glad to respond to any questions or comments. Thank you. So as I was saying, we always honor those who came before us, who walked this path, this spiritual path, in this search for closeness, for devikut, for cleaving with God. We always honor them because they came before us and they learned things on the way that they passed down to us in the teachings of mysticism, which have been handed down by word of mouth, orally, from the beginning, and then later were written down. We honor them also because we are the sum total of who they were. We are not individually only ourselves. Our DNA comes half from our mother and half from our father, and so on and so forth, all the way back, so that we are, in every sense of the word, the sum total of our ancestors, and our ancestors live on within us. And of course, this is recognized in Exodus, when God says that he rewards the righteous to the thousandth generation, and he punishes the iniquities of the father by holding them against the son, their sons and daughters, unto the third and to the fourth generations. And so it's recognized that we are indeed our fathers and mothers' sons and daughters, and that a part of them lives on in us. And so this is why it is at the beginning of each class I recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead, because it is a way of honoring those who came before us, of whom we are made, and whose merits we are rewarded for, and whose sins and transgressions we are held responsible to correct. We are held responsible to correct. Not that we're punished for them, but that we are held responsible to perform a tikkun, to correct those transgressions. All right, enough on that line. Now, I have been teaching for the last couple of times on the early books, which, as I said, Kabbalah has relied on, and which over time became, well, were a part of that greater, broader stream known as Jewish mysticism, which continually evolves and then later becomes distinctly around the year 1000 AD, or Common Era, as it's now called, became Kabbalism, as opposed to Merkabah mysticism and Pallas or Hall mysticism, the Hekhalot literature, Hekhalot mysticism. It continually evolves, and now it's referred to as Kabbalah. But essentially what it is a Jewish type of mysticism. And so I've been doing a brief survey of the early books. This means prior to the Bahir and the Zohar and Sefer Yetzirah, which became known after, and when I say known, I mean to a large number of people, began to be written down and circulated without being hidden away, as it was prior to the turn of the first millennium. So these all came to be, those three books came to be in wider circulation among the mystics after the turn of the first millennium, around the year 1000 AD or CE. So I'm talking about now those books that preceded that, and I talked about before the first book was Sefer HaRaziel, which means Book of the Mystery of God, which was handed down from the angel Raziel to Adam when he was cast out of Gan Eden. And then the last two meetings I've talked about in leading up to the Book of Enoch. We haven't got to the Book of Enoch yet because I've been talking about Enoch himself, the patriarch who was the seventh generation descendant of Adam through Seth. So he was the seventh. He was the patriarch of the seventh generation of the line of righteousness, as opposed to the line of evil that came from the mixed patriarchy, or the mixed patrimony, I should say the mixed genetics, the mixed spiritual genetics of Cain and Abel, whose father was only partially Adam, whose mother, of course, was Hava, but whose father, both the father of both Cain and Abel, were not entirely Adam, for we are taught in oral Torah that Nahash, the serpent, lusted after Hava, and entered into her, and mixed his seed with the seed of Adam. And so Cain, who was born first, came out mostly with the of the side of Nahash, the serpent, which is the side of Samael, Hasatan, the adversary. And Abel came out about half with the attributes of his father Adam and his father Nahash, the serpent. And so he was, as it says in the Zohar, the same as good wine mixed with bad. But neither of those are the pure seed of Adam. The pure seed of Adam didn't happen until Adam had intercourse with his wife Eve, again, after they left Gan Eden. And then in Genesis it tells us that this is the role of the generations of Adam. And if you'll notice, it doesn't mention anything about Cain or Abel. Nothing at all about Cain or Abel. It starts off with talking about when Adam was 130 years, his wife Eve bore him a son, and they named him Seth. That's the first son of pure seed brought into the world of Adam and Eve. The others were mixed seed, partly Adam, partly Nahash, the serpent in the garden. And so the first seed of the righteous, the line of the righteous in the world, came when Adam was 130 years old, and Seth was born. All right, so Enoch now was of the seventh generation of man. Before him came, of course, Adam, then Seth, then Enosh, then Canaan, then Mahalalel, and then Enoch's father, Jared. And so he was of the seventh generation. And of course, the number seven is very Kabbalistically, mystically significant. It represents, I'm kind of reviewing here, so bear with me if you've heard this before, but the number seven represents completion. It's the number of the Sabbath. It's the seventh day on which God finished the creation and rested from his work. It represents the 7 days of the week, which means the cycle of time. The cycle of time. So it means that when we come to Enoch, a cycle has been completed. A mystical cycle has come into fullness with the birth of Enoch. There's the seven notes of the musical scale, which we call in the West the octave, but which, if you look at it, both the first and the last note, do, are the same note. So there's really only seven different notes in the octave. There's the seven holy sephirot below the world of emanation, Atzilut. They represent all of creation. Atzilut's the world of emanation, and everything below it is creation. It's the world of space, matter, and time. It's the lower physical world of man in comparison to the upper spiritual world of God. Enoch was the great-grandfather of Noah. So Enoch was the father of Methuselah, the grandfather of Lamech, and the great father of Noah, who represented the 10th generation of man in the world. And of course, number 10 represents fullness and judgment. I won't go into why that is. I've done this before. But it was during that 10th generation that God repented that he had made man, and then destroyed the world with the great flood. And then we also mentioned that, unlike the other patriarchs, showing his the differentiation between him and the other patriarchs. All the other patriarchs were living at the time between 700 and 900 years, but Enoch lived only 365 years. It tells us this in written Torah. So why would he live such a shorter time, and why the number 365? Well, the number 365 is the length, of course, of the solar year. There's 365 days in the Earth year, the length of time it takes us to complete all of the four seasons. So if you look at this, that means that Enoch lived 365 days, that's 1 year, times 365 revolutions around the sun. So that's 365 squared. The number of his days, and elsewhere in the Bible, we are always told, and we see this phrase, the number of his days were, and then there'll be a number. And that's what it's talking, we can apply that to this here. The number of Enoch's days were 365 squared. That's 133,225 days. And a solar square, because that's what this is, an Earth year, you know, is, or a solar year is an Earth year of 365 Earth days. Okay, a solar square is a symbol of perfection. Why do I say that? Because the sun is also the symbol of a couple of different of the holy sephirot in the Ezekiel, the tree of life. It is a symbol of Chokmah, supernal wisdom. It's also a symbol of Tiferet Yisrael, the beauty of Israel, which is also named HaKodesh Baruch Hu, Holy One, Blessed Be He, or just the Blessed Holy One. Also, the square in geometry is the polyhedron that's closest to that of the circle. So it's the closest we can draw and not have a circle, but be closest to the circle in perfection is the square. That's why we've always heard of like the impossible task of squaring the circle. It's not possible. You cannot bring into the human realm the perfection of God completely. The circle represents God. The square represents the perfected human. Circle is God. Square is human. But what this means here, that Enoch lived 365 years, which is 365 days squared, is that he was the closest thing to God that had so far been on the earth at that time. And so why else did he only live that number of time? Because that was the period in which he was fulfilled. He became perfected. He became perfected and became the first man to be carried up out of this life without dying. And as it says in Genesis, it says, and I don't have the citation with me right here, but let's see if I can find it really quickly here. And I'm not seeing it right away. One last quick scan here. Here it is. Genesis 5:24. That's the citation that I wanted to give you. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more because God took him away. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more because God took him away. Genesis 5:24. So God lifted him up to heaven without him dying. And more about this we'll talk later, because he then became an angel, at least according to the book of Enoch. Okay. All right. So this puts him in the same category of piety as his great-grandson Noah. Why? Because it tells us here in 5:4, Genesis 5:4, that he walked with God. That's the same phrase that we have in Genesis 6:9 of Noah, that he walked with God. This means that he communed with God, that he journeyed along the path, the mystical path of righteousness, Derech Hashem, the way of God. So this put him in the same category of piety as his great-grandson Noah. which was three generations away. God was preparing the world for the righteous in the world for what was coming three generations later. All right. And then in our last meeting, we started talking about, that's a little bit about the Enoch as an individual, and then I wanted to put him in the context of his time in the Bible. So we taught a little bit about that, and I will just sort of briefly go over that again, because there's a lot of concepts in here to grasp. This is an important time in the Torah's history of early man. Now remember also, this history that Torah is teaching us here, was there really a man named Enoch? Was there really a man named Noah? There's no way to prove that. There's no way to objectively prove the historicity, the historical existence of these biblical figures. That's an impossibility. We don't have the historical systems. We didn't have the record-keeping systems intact and the redundancies in those systems intact. Maybe somewhere in the Library of Alexandria that was burned to the ground by the Christian zealots. Maybe there was a scroll that in which this was all recorded at the time. We have no way of knowing that, but it's not here now. Maybe it'll be found at some time in a cave out east of Jerusalem, overlooking the Dead Sea, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. Maybe there's another cave holding some more scrolls. We don't know that at this time. But it doesn't matter. The history that the Torah teaches us is nothing more than a set of moral lessons, ethical lessons that are designed to teach us how to live our lives on the way of God, on the path of God, Derech Hashem. But on a deeper level, we get the spiritual history of God and man. And that's what this time is beginning to teach us about. This portion of Bereshit, starting with chapter 6, is starting to teach us about the first time, about the struggle in God's mind. The struggle between that part of God who wanted to create the world and create man to be the other, in quotes, the other divine being with which God could share his perfect goodness, and that part of God's mind that said, hold on here, let's think about this, I don't think that's such a good idea. The doubting part of God's mind, the part of the suspicious, skeptical part of God's mind, that the part that was cautious and restrictive and holds back, the left-hand side of God's mind versus the right-hand side, that's proactive and says, let's go forward. Let's create a creature who's capable of appreciating our perfect goodness. Let's call that creature, let's make that creature in our form and likeness and call that creature man, Adam. And that part, that's the right-hand side of God. And then there's the left-hand side of God that said, no, don't do that. That's not a good idea. He's going to do nothing but sin and mess things up. He's going to spoil the world and creation. He's going to get in nothing but incessant wars and kill each other and kill himself. And he's going to spoil everything, mess it up, and he's going to be nothing but a disappointment and a heartache to us. Do not do it. We're perfectly content living entirely in the Spirit, living entirely as the spiritual all. The spiritual totality. We don't need to carve a space out of our belly and withdraw all of our wonderful golden light and create a void, a tahiru, a place in which we will create this artificial universe that's physical and has time, and so that there's a procession of cause and effect ad infinitum, in which all these things happen, and then we'll put man down there and create this being that's, especially, I don't like the idea that this being is going to be higher than the angels. I don't like that at all. because you create the angels to create all of the universe and to keep it running. Why should this creature down there who you're going to put an evil urge in, as well a Yetzer Hara, as well as an urge to do good, Yetzer HaTov, you're going to make this creature a creature of two hearts, a creature of two urges. And so he's going to always fall prey to the evil urge. They're going to be a preponderance of black-hearted individuals. Don't do it. And there's no way that I'm going to bow my knee to that creature. Now, who I'm talking about here, which I'm sure you've suspected, the Christians have named Satan. But they stole that word from the Jews. It's actually Hebrew. It's Hasatan. And all it means is the adversary. It doesn't mean the devil. There's no such thing as a devil. There's no separate being from God. God is Kol, K-O-L, all. God is the all. God is all, and God is in everything. God is in the nature that's to do good in man, and God is in the nature to do evil that's in man. God is in the wars and the plagues that destroy everything. Don't think so? Look at the story in Exodus when he sent the seven plagues to Egypt. And he hardened. Remember he told this to Moses? He said, I will harden. This is at the burning bush. He says, I'm going to send you to retrieve my children. And you're going to say, set my people free. And I'm going to harden his heart against me, God, so that I can show the whole world the power of your God. So first God makes Pharaoh ignore the pleas of Moses to set free the Israelite people who've been captive in Egypt for 400 years, and then he punishes him for it, sends seven plagues. And it's God himself, the angel of death, Samael, walking through the streets of Egypt, taking the firstborn of every kind, the firstborn of all their flocks of sheep, all their herds of cattle, all their flocks of birds, the firstborn of their children. He takes them all. He kills them all. This is God. God is a God of death as well as a God of life. He's not the Christian concept of this woolly-haired, white woolly-haired old man with a long beard sitting in a white robe on a throne, and he's got little kids coming up to him like Santa Claus and bouncing them on their knees and giving them cookies, sugar cookies. That is one aspect only of God. That's chesed. That's hakma. That's Abba. But there's the whole left-hand side of God. And there's this division in the mind of God, and it's that division in the mind of God that has led to internal conflict in God. And because God is all, and God is in everything, that conflict is not confined only to his mind, to God's mind. It plays itself out everywhere in all of reality, and indeed in all realities, plural, all realities. Another way to look at it is the only reality is God, and that this universe and our lives in it and the pathetic history of mankind in this world is nothing more than a series of scenes in the unfolding conflict in the mind of God in a dream that God has of this universe. We can look at it that way, that God is dreaming. And as he dreams, this is the way the Buddhists look at it, that God is having a dream and that this reality is that dream. It's real for us, but it's a dream to God. So you can look at it however you want. The bottom line is there's nothing else but God. God is in philosophical terms, let's talk about metaphysics. There's two categories of things. One category is essential. The other is conditional. Conditional means that everything in that set, you set theory here, right? A set is a group that share a common attribute. Okay, in the set of things that are conditional, what that is defined as is meaning everything that's conditional owes its existence to something outside the set. It didn't create itself. It didn't come about spontaneously of itself. And so that would be creation, all of creation. And the other set is everything that's considered, is called essential being, and that is God. And that's defined as something that doesn't owe its existence to anything but itself, that exists of and in itself, and is eternal, had no beginning, had no cause. This is why sometimes the philosophers talk about God as being the uncaused cause, the unmoved mover, the cause of all causes. That's what it's referring to here. God is the essential being. The only thing we know for sure that exists is God. We don't know for sure that we exist, but I digress too far into metaphysics here. We're going to assume we exist by virtue of the fact that we feel and we think and we move around and we have physical bodies. And is that illusory, as the Hindus and the Buddhists say? Well, we can't prove that because that's the nature of metaphysics, is there's no empirical method of proof for that. So I'm going to go on faith that we exist, but I'm also going to go on faith that the only thing that truly exists is God. And God has a dual nature, a nature that is dark and a nature that is light, a nature that is loving and a nature that is wrathful and hateful and filled with revenge, vengeful, a nature that is male, a nature that is female, a nature that wants things to grow and fructify and bloom and always expand and get better and better, and a nature that wants to restrict and withdraw and pull back into itself. And this is the conflict that I'm giving you a taste of that's been going on in God's mind since before, even though before is a preposition, I guess, is the part of speech that is, but it's one that doesn't apply to God because God is transcendent of time and space and matter. But it's been going on at least from the time that God considered creation and making man, putting man here. And so this is the time period now in the seventh generation of man. It started out right at the beginning with the fact that there's Nakash, the evil serpent, in the garden. He got into the garden to tempt man because he wanted to make man fail. And so it started to play out there. But where it really starts, and it played out further in the fact that Nahash's evil, doubting spirit went largely into Cain, who then slew Abel, his brother, who was kind of a neutral character. And then it's passed on down through the descendants of Cain. And is continually being played out through the history and the course of history in mankind, through both personal relations and families, and in relations between clans and tribes, cities, villages, nations, right on down to the present. But where the Bible really starts to talk about it is here in the sixth chapter of Bereshit. And leading up to where God decides that the only way that he can stop this from playing out and from this conflict, which is going to spoil his creation, is to destroy the earth. Now I'm going to read the first seven verses of chapter 6 of Bereshit, which is often named Genesis in English. And you'll see this here starting to play out. Verse 1, and it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were pretty. And they took as wives all those whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. Excuse me. There were Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men of old, men of renown. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord repented that he had made man on earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the birds of the air, for I repent that I have made them. Now, I'll just discuss this just a little bit, because I discuss it quite a bit Monday. What it's telling us here is that by the seventh generation of the righteous, those descended from Adam through Seth, this would be the time of Enoch, that man had begun to multiply quite a bit on the earth. His population was growing. And at that time, it says, the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Now, who are the sons of God? In Hebrew, it's Benai HaElohim. Benai HaElohim. We know from Oral Torah, which I discussed a little bit yesterday, that this is a reference to the fallen angels, which is mentioned actually by name as the fallen ones in verse 4 in this same chapter 6 of Genesis, verse 4, where it says, there were Nephilim, which literally translated means fallen ones, in the earth in those days. So the sons of God are the angels. And we learned yesterday, and we'll learn more on Monday as we continue this, about this in more detail, that there were two angels named Uzzah and Azazel. These were angels directly below the level of the archangel Samael. Now remember, I just talked to you about Samael. He was the angel of doubt. He was the doubting side of God's mind. And he had his angels who worked under his supervision. And two of these, the highest, were Uzzah and Azazel. And later in the book of Enoch, they're called the Watchers. I won't get into that right now as to why. Later I will. But this is Uzzah and Azazel. And these are the ones who saw, who were cast out of heaven for refusing, along with Samael, for refusing to bend their knee to Adam. Not Adam, who's Adam and Hava, but Adam Kadmon, primordial man. This is the image that's spoken of in Genesis around 126, when it says, let us make man, and let us make man in our image and likeness. This is a primordial image of God in the form of man. Okay, it's not an individual man. It's not the first physical man named Adam that later God blew his breath into. He made first the primordial image, Adam Kadmon. And this, in terms of the hierarchy of the Sephirotic tree, is above Keter. It's above Keter. It's not even shown in the diagram of the Ten Sephirot, because it's not one of the Sephirot. It's the primordial image of God in man. It's the Adam Kadmon, and God made that image at a higher level of holiness and sanctity and spirituality than he did the angels. Now we know this because God tells us this in the Oral Torah, but also because if you just look at the levels from top to bottom of the Sephirotic tree, you'll see that the world of the angels is in the world below the world of the throne. The world of the throne is first of all, at the top we have the world of emanation, Atzilut. Then that's the top three. The first triad, the top three Sephirot. Then the next three Sephirot is the world of Berea, the world of creation. That's the world of the throne. Remember throne mysticism? Merkaba mysticism? And then below that is the world of Yetzirah, the world of formation. This is the world of the angels. That's the level of the angels. The angels were below the throne. This is the world of Samael and those below him. This is the world of Uzzah and Aziel. Okay, but where did I just tell you that when God made man, he said, let us make him in our image and likeness, and he did so? Well, where that is outside the diagram of the holy tree entirely. It's above that. It's above that. It's in between Ein Sof and Keter. And that's where Adam Kadmon is. That's a fifth world in the cosmogony of Isaac Luria. That's the fifth world. There's five, not four, in Isaac Luria's Kabbalah. Okay, and so they were required to kneel, or a Torah tells us that they were required to kneel to show their respect and honor to and to show that they acknowledged his superiority. And all the angels of the universe did this. All the angels of the heavens, except for Samael, who said infamously, I shall not kneel. I shall not kneel to this creature. And of course, the Christians, then they turned that into a legend and said there was a big war in heaven, etc., etc., and you know that story. The fact is this is the conflict in the mind of God. It's never been resolved. It's not resolved today. And it's one of the reasons that God made man, is to help him resolve that conflict. To help him resolve that conflict. That has to do with what's called tikkun ha-panim, which means spiritual repair of the face, ha-panim, the face. The face of what? The face of God. The face of God that is split into two halves, a right and a left half. A light and a dark half, like if you look at the image, the diagram of the Tao. And that's what we're dealing with here. Okay, I'm going to stop here because I'm running along too long in time. And we'll continue along. I wanted to kind of put all of this in a perspective. Why it's important to spend this much time on the Book of Enoch is not so much about the book as it is about the time that it represents in the history of God's struggle within his own divine mind between the two sides, his attempts to reconcile the two, to unify them into a whole, of which we are a part of that struggle. That's a part of our holy Avodah. All right, well, that's all that I've got for today. I hope you enjoyed this. If you enjoyed it, come back again on Monday. In the meantime, I want to make an announcement that day after tomorrow, Erev Shabbat, please come at 10 p.m. Eastern Time to our room in Paltalk, and I will be leading a short Sabbath worship, and then afterwards you'll all be invited to join me at my Shabbat table for singing, dancing, and storytelling, and just general celebration and rejoicing, and I think you'll enjoy that if you come. In the meantime, now all of these teachings that I do live are recorded, and they're saved as MP3 files on our website. At the top of your page, if you scroll up on Paltalk, you'll find that when you came in, you were greeted, and there's our website URL is there. For those of you who can't find that, it's www.beitshemtov.org. Beitshemtov.org. All right, that's going to be all for today. And for those of you who want to stick around or have some questions to ask me, I'll open it up for questions after I get done and save this file. So just bear with me for a minute, and then I'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to remember God at least twice today, twice tomorrow, twice every day. And until we meet again, may you go from strength to strength and be well. Zygesund.